Everyone, welcome back to the Brain Soul Success Show. You are in for a real treat today. I have with me my friend Jeff Krasnow. He is the co-founder and CEO of Commune. It's a masterclass platform for personal and societal well-being. He hosts the Commune podcast, interviewing a wide variety of luminaries from Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, Matthew McConaughey, oh my gosh, Gabor Mate, Jeff Pence, a personal weekly essay titled Commute. How do you say that? Commusings.
You got it.
Commusings. I love that. That explores spirituality, wellness, and culture and is distributed to over 1 million subscribers every Sunday. Jeff's the creator of Good Stress. It's a collection of wellness protocols that he developed to reverse his own diabetes, lost 60 pounds, reclaimed his health at age 50. Good Stress is available as an online course that's being developed into a book and a TV series. Good for you. I love this, Jeff. I'm so excited to be with you today and all the good work that you're doing in the world. And you know, it's not really talked about. We don't talk about stress being good, do we?
No, we don't. And for good reason, Louise. And first of all, thanks so much for hosting me, and it's a pleasure to connect with you and to the community that you're building. It's really fantastic. Yeah, I mean, stress in the modern era is generally associated with distress, right? So bad stress. And this is a crucial delineation to make, because we actually evolved with some health conferring Paleolithic good stresses. But of course, in modern life, which is characterized by endless pressure and fear and judgment, and you know, nonstop 24-hour news and social media, et cetera, we essentially, you know, experience life as if we're being, you know, chased by some odd toad ungulate all the time.
Yes.
And we never have an opportunity to emotionally regulate it and bounce back to center. So this chronic IV drip of stress is really deleterious to, you know, both our psychology and our physiology. You know, I think a lot of your audience is probably familiar with sort of the endocrine cascade that's associated with bad stress.
Right.
You know, there's obviously the hormone, steroid hormone cortisol, which a lot of people are familiar with. And cortisol is actually shouldn't be completely villainized, because it's a wonderful hormone in the right doses at the right time. We have a natural cortisol wave in the morning, which gets a sleepyhead out of bed and helps him and her confront the day, and is an important hormone for alertness. But of course, when we're chronically stimulated and we have chronically activated cortisol, that, you know, degrades the immune system, it degrades the gut. It obviously triggers, you know, glucose from the liver and sends it to your extremities, because you're ready to fight and fly, right? But but of course, you know, when that never goes away, you know, we experience all of these detrimental knock-on impacts. But okay, so that's bad stress. That's modern distress. But we actually evolved with these good health-conferring Paleolithic stressors. So, for example, we were designed to deal with a certain amount of like food scarcity, right? Because, you know, we had periods of abundance on the Serengeti, and then we had, you know, winter's fallow. And the body, it is just this, you know, unbelievable miracle that basically evolved all these mechanisms in relation to its environment. So we were around for hundreds of thousands of years, and our hominid ancestors for millions of years, developing this kind of engineering. And we were actually engineered to be fat just a little bit in the fall and in the late summer, because guess what was around the corner? You know, a scarcity of calories related to winter's fallow. So, you know, so we were actually designed to store energy in the form of fat at a certain time of year. But then what happens when culture essentially hijacks our biology, takes our miraculous adaptive mechanisms and makes them maladaptive. Well, when you supply the body with an endless abundance of a surfeit of nutrient deficient, refined grains and refined sugars, et cetera, what do? We do what we're designed to do, which is store fat. But of course, when we do that nonstop, you get an obesity epidemic. 45% of Americans are now obese. And I think, 11 or 12% are morbidly obese. And, this is really, our genetics haven't changed. In the 60s, that number was 5%. So, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but over the last 70 years, our genes really haven't changed at all. So what can you point to? Well, you point to culture and lifestyle, essentially the way we live our lives. And, all these chronic diseases as they relate to the brain as well, which is obviously, your area of expertise, but these neurodegenerative diseases and dementia and Alzheimer's, et cetera, a lot of people are talking about them as metabolic diseases now. Yes. So we're seeing this massive cresting wave of dementia. And in many ways, what you're seeing in these kind of autopsies of hippocampal tissue, and et cetera, is, insulin resistance and the inability to essentially use substrates like glucose for the creation of energy. So then you get this brain energy problem. And so, this is an example of essentially like evolutionary mismatches that have started to characterize our modern era. And what I say is like, the source of chronic disease is really chronic ease. It's this abundance that we have all the time, all this endless comfort.
Oh, that's a great point, Jeff. Yes. You know what I see on my neurobiofeedback programs and when I work with people with brain issues is the sugar issue. It's digestion of sugar. It's the glucose, because everything really does turn to sugar. And I know you know that very well with your story on sugar. So I see Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and all of that as that metabolism of sugar and glucose. And also I see it as the traumas that got stuck in the spaces of the brain. So I clear trauma, but I clear it at the brain soul level. And so what I found is I found that many of those people are holding on to childhood wounds or things that are stuck, and it's taking up space in the brain. And so that's the spiritual cause. The physical cause is that metabolism, how they're metabolizing.
Yeah. Well, metabolism is an interesting word because I try to apply it, sort of loosely. I mean, obviously we think about metabolism as, all of the chemical reactions in the body that take food substrates and convert them into energy, et cetera. But there's also, one has the ability to metabolize trauma. And, if you can move through the trauma, right? And you create essentially openness and pathways for that trauma to essentially integrate. But of course, just like when you have an overabundance of sugar in your diet, your metabolism is compromised. Mm-hmm. When you have, an overabundance of neglect or, toxicity or racism or abuse, it becomes harder and more difficult to essentially metabolize that trauma. And we need to obviously engage in a lot of inventory. And fortunately, there seems to be more tools available kind of coming online now with psychedelic therapy and ketamine-assisted therapy and obviously the work that you're doing to help people essentially move through that trauma and to heal wounds such that they can be more available.
Right, absolutely. And being more available, that's a very good point. Because I know you went through a journey too. And at the time that you were not feeling well, you probably were not feeling available. You weren't feeling like 100% yourself. So share that with us because you have a powerful story. What happened and how long ago was that?
Yeah. So prior to starting a commune, I was the founder and the CEO of a company called Wanderlust. It was just a wonderful and awful time of my life, kind of at the same time. Wanderlust was a series of wellness events that spread across the world. Sorry, one second. These events like that spread all across the world, and that we brought together some of like the greatest teachers and thought leaders and authors, and it was wonderful. We were doing very, very large scale events, but my life was constantly on an airplane. There was a tremendous amount of pressure involved because these events were incredibly labor intensive and very capital intensive. So I was always raising money and running around doing partnerships and sponsorships and et cetera. And of course, it was ironic because here I was in the wellness industry, but experiencing myself as patently unwell. And in 2018, I sold the company. And I, really spiraled into a depression. I was significantly overweight, but I had all of these other kind of symptoms that are just so common that we've accepted them as normal, but they're completely abnormal. I mean, and I'm sure you come across these all the time, Louise. I mean, I had wicked brain fog, just chronic fatigue, just tired all the time. I was irritable. I couldn't concentrate. I mean, I think I read in 2017 a grand total of zero books. And then, I had, some physical presentations that were certainly insulting to my vanity. I started to grow these little brown skin tags in my armpits, which I later found out was a kind of a presentation of insulin resistance and diabetes. I had what my wife nicely refers to as gynecomastia, but the rest of the world knows as man boobs, and not necessarily A cups, and so I was just in a very in a place of rock bottom. I mean, there was also some other psychological components to it. I mean, my life and my identity was very much based on what I did and sort of the exalted status I had in my little corner of the universe as CEO of this company and with, 200 employees and 68 events and 20 countries and all this stuff. And then I didn't have that anymore. And so there was a forced interoception, like, who am I? And as I stared into the mirror, I did not like who I saw, both physically and psychologically. Then I started to, my friend had started this company called Levels, which is a continuous glucose monitor company. So I actually wear one for the people watching this on video. I have a little disc on my triceps
Oh, cool.
that I wear, and that links with an app. And that gives me a dashboard into my blood glucose moment to moment. And it's a very useful tool, though it's easy to become obsessed with it. But I don't suggest that one does. But I put it on and I stared into the app, and I was agog, really, that my fasting glucose levels were 125 milligrams per deciliter. So that might not mean very much to most people, but that is on the very, very highest end of prediabetes and on the lower end of diabetes. And I went to my primary care physician, and she gave me a hemoglobin A1C test, which is generally in a panel that you'll get when you go, if you go to see your internist. And there you had it. I had like a hemoglobin A1C of about 6.7%. So again, that was kind of in the lower end of the diabetic spectrum. And I was like, whoa, me? Like, I'm in the wellness industry. I eat organic food. I've like raised my daughters well. I pay my taxes, damn it. Like, I can't, I'm not one of the, I'm not, I can't be a diabetic. What? I can't have a chronic disease. But I woke up to the fact that, again, that is abnormally normal in our society. I mean, there's, you know, 12% of Americans now have diabetes, and another 38 to 40% have prediabetes, and 90% of those people are undiagnosed. And, you know, this is right barely upstream from, you know, heart disease, cancer, stroke, dementia. In fact, dementia, as I'm sure you know, is now often referred to as type 3 diabetes.
Yes.
You know, due to essentially the neurons in your brain and their inability to actually make energy, you know, at the subcellular level. So that was me in 2019, 2020, even. So not even really that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once I learned that I had an official diagnosis, it really propelled me into a place of what I call me search, or I became kind of an N-of-1 experiment. And fortunately, you know, I had developed relationships with really some of the most prolific functional and integrative medicine doctors in the world. And I, you know, embarked on this kind of period of autodidactic learning on my podcast and on Commune. And I've interviewed maybe 500 doctors kind of over the last 4 years, and have made, you know, courses on brain health and metabolism and autoimmune disease, and with, you know, everyone from Dr. Mark Hyman to Casey Means and Sarah Gottfried and David Perlmutter, and et cetera. So, and over that period, you know, basically did a tremendous amount of experimentation. And as you know, Louise, this world is full of advice. So, you know, what I call kind of sifting through the grifting of the wellness industry was certainly part of my journey, and all the mushrooms and modalities and pills and praxis, and, you know, jumping into 40 degree water while you're, you know, saying a mantra on a pomegranate fast or whatever. You know, I really did experiment with quite a few things. And then, you know, found some candidly very old and true protocols that I began to apply and stack into my life. And, you know, the results were pretty miraculous. You know, just across my body, mind, and affected every part of my life. And, you know, we so often associate health with downward spirals. Mm-hmm. And certainly there are downward spirals, you know, but there are also the good news, the gospel is there are upward spirals. And as I began to adopt certain protocols, combine them in interesting ways, I started to experience upward spirals in my life. And you know, I apologize for this, but our DNA is 99.9% the same. But, you know, and we, you know, we all are bio-individual. Everything is different for a lot of people. But there are general principles that can apply, you know, to all of us. And so, yeah, now I'm, you know, on a mission to share some of those principles such that people can really get that information and apply it to themselves and take agency over their own health and really bend the arc of their life. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Wow. I mean, I love your insights, you know, and I appreciate your sense of humor. Let me say that too. You know, I'm really loving your insights. Protocols, when you talk about protocols, give us one tip, because I went down a similar journey, only I crashed. So I was oxygen for 3 years. I was 89 pounds and dying. And so three autoimmune diseases. So, and I lost my brain power at the time. I had been a special ed teacher before that. So I kind of say I taught those kids, became like the kids I taught, which is kind of true. So that's how I became a brain expert. But I too went down that kind of journey. And I love how you talk about upward spiral, because I never thought of that when I was going through it. I love that, Jeff. That's so awesome. So yeah, what's a tip, you know, a protocol that you say, hey, you know what? We're all like different, but we still have we're still people, we're still mammals, we still have to eat, we still have to sleep, we still have to poop, we, you know, we have to do all those things. So what are some, like, across the board kind of tips that you might give somebody who might be on a similar journey?
Yeah, well, before I get into specific ones, I'll just give you more of a general one. You know, okay. I mentioned this earlier. You know, we are not fixed products. That's not what this organism is. We are processes, changing moment to moment in relation to our environment. You know, the Buddha said that, and then quantum physics said that, and now we're learning that through neuroplasticity and epigenetics and the microbiome, et cetera. And you know, if you accept that, then, you know, you really want to look at how this engineering of the human organism came to be. And like I said before, it evolved in relation to its environment, to its exposome, to the total amount of exposures that we have in our life. And so what I became very focused on is living in alignment with how I evolved, like going back and thinking about how did we live 12,000 years ago before there was really any dementia or Alzheimer's, before there was any metabolic disease, before there was any heart disease, before there was really very much cancer. There was a little cancer back then, but not much. And so that was the question that I asked myself: how do I live a little bit more like my Paleolithic ancestor? Nice. And once I started to kind of ask that question, the answers really revealed themselves, to be honest. So, you know, for example, we talked about food for a second before. So my Paleolithic ancestors did experience periods of food scarcity. So now, how could I self-impose periods of food scarcity in order to give my body an opportunity to repair and restore and not just grow? So for me, that became an intermittent fasting protocol. So I began to consolidate all my consumption of food in an 8-hour window. That's often known as the 16-8 protocol. Now, this protocol isn't for everyone. Certainly for women going through menopause, or if you're menstruating or gestating, et cetera, you want to figure this out and move into it slowly. But for me, this was an incredibly effective protocol. For me, it helped me lose a lot of weight. Now, of course, you can eat 20 pints of ice cream in 8 hours, so you wouldn't lose weight if you did that. Right. But, you know, if you become more conscious and mindful about not stuffing your face every minute of the day, you will generally lose weight. But there's all of these other incredible benefits to doing that. So, you know, that was one thing that I focused on. Another thing was, like, I looked at my wall and I saw this really wonderful, innovative digital thermometer or thermostat that could keep me at a snuggly little 72 degrees at all times. Isn't that nice? But doing that, I wasn't leveraging all of these adaptive mechanisms that are part of my evolution. Like 12,000 years ago on the Serengeti of East Africa, I had to endure big fluctuations in temperature. And in fact, you know, you obviously the dose makes the poison, right? You don't want to be hypothermic or hyperthermic, but the right dosage of extreme heat or extreme cold actually activates all of these longevity and resilience pathways in the human body. So I began to experiment with exposure to heat and to cold, and that had incredible benefits. I mean, for a whole bunch of physiological benefits, but if you're thinking about the brain, for example, you know, getting in cold water will activate the production and release of dopamine over a 48-hour period after the session itself. So, you know, for mood regulation, getting in cold water and challenging yourself to do hard things like that can really yield a tremendous amount of benefits. Getting into extreme heat, like if you get into a sauna, for example, 4 times a week for about 20 minutes at about 180, 190 degrees Fahrenheit, you'll see a all host of benefits, including the production of a particular kind of protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, probably familiar with it, called BDNF. Mm-hmm. And this particular molecule helps neurons function and also stimulates the production of new neurons, neurobiogenesis, you know, later in life even. We used to think for 50 years that our brains were essentially were fixed by the after the time we were 25. Well, thankfully, you know, this emerging field of neuroplasticity has come around. And yes, our brains are a lot more plastic and malleable, and neurons grow before, you know, when you're younger in that period, in adolescence up to the, you know, 25, 26 years old. But now we're showing that you can engage and adopt particular activities, exercise, fasting, sauna, that will actually activate the growth of new neurons later in life. And that's amazing. So,
isn't it amazing? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, these were just, you know, a couple of things. I you know, there were, you know, really over time, I kind of put together 10 core protocols that I stacked into my daily life that I, you know, I try to practice every day. And I'd say, like, you know, I'm not neurotic or fundamentalist about it. You know, I wouldn't call myself an Epicurean, but, you know, I'd like to have a good time, and I like to go out and be with friends. And, you know, I don't always take my last bite of food 3 hours before I go to bed, although I know that's what I should do. Tonight, I'm actually have a wonderful dinner party with a bunch of doctors. And I'm sure we're going to hang out, you know, and do things that are probably, quote unquote, not good for us, like probably have a glass of wine. And but, you know, these are some of the, this is why, you know, I'm not fundamentalist about all of these things. But generally, I try to, you know, adopt these protocols. And I've seen, like I said, miraculous results.
That's really awesome. Thank you for sharing all that. I, too, have used sauna. When I was really sick, I was in a sauna, like a medical sauna program for 5 weeks, sweating heavy metals and chemicals out of my body, and completely fascinated and learned so much and met so many amazing people. So I do a lot of similar protocols that you do, only I didn't find it through asking myself the same questions. Like, what did they do? What did our ancestors do? Although I have said we need to go back and eat the way great-great-grandma did.
Absolutely.
Like grow your own food, have organic, you know, organic food, eat from the earth, eat what you're supposed to be eating in the climate that you're in, you know, and for the time period that you're in.
Just cook more, just be in the kitchen more. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, again, you know, our lives have evolved for comfort and convenience, you know, so much so that, you know, I can pick up my phone and, you know, by the end of our conversation, I could have like a pineapple delivered to my front door, right? You know, 24/7, 365 days a year, whether or not it was in season or not. And, you know, and a pineapple might be one of the better things I could have delivered, candidly, you know, given the standard American diet that we seem to be so successful at exporting around the world. But, you know, there's so many things, like, for example, you know, sleep is foundational to mental health, to our psychology, to our physiology. You know, even one night's bad sleep can raise your insulin resistance. Now, of course, like, you look at that and you try to act, you know, why does a bad night's sleep actually make you more resistant to insulin? Well, again, you almost always find the same answer. Like, it's actually by design. It's like, you know, when typically did we get less sleep 12,000 years ago? Well, in the summer, you know, because the days were longer, we became a little bit more insulin resistant. Why? Because we wanted to, instead of using energy substrates for energy production, we wanted to store more fat in the late summer and early fall for winter again. So I, you know, so almost all of the, you know, when you ask yourself, why does the body do that? It almost always comes down to, you know, you finding an adaptive answer to that question. But, you know, for example, with sleep, you know, we are once again being upended by modern culture and technology. I mean, you know, right now, candidly, I'm surrounded by about 8 different screens, right?
Yes.
They're all emitting a certain band of the electromagnetic wave spectrum called blue light. And, you know, blue light, we were designed, the sort of inferior, these neurons in the inferior part of our retina were designed to sense this particular band of light, around 380 nanometers. And through that sensitivity set our circadian rhythm through this kind of chain reaction, such that, you know, cortisol in the earlier part of the day would be balanced by the secretion of melatonin, you know, from the pineal gland about 14 hours later. And that beautiful little teeter-totter was balanced by being outside in the morning and getting morning light, which is blue, and then sitting around the fire with friends at night, which is amber light, which had no impact on your endocrine cascade. So again, the answers were right there in our history, in our evolution. So, you know, what do? Well, we can wake up and make our cup of tea or cup of coffee, and then get outside first thing in the morning. And that can help to set our circadian rhythm. And then what do we not do? Well, we don't get that blue light at night when we want our melatonin to be secreted. And there's all sorts of kind of sleep hygiene and architecture that you can adopt around that. But a big one is, you know, putting like a night shift function on all of your screens, or putting your screens away, having more amber light in your house at night, which actually makes it feel more warm and snuggly. Being mindful about when you eat, so you're not eating when you're too close to bedtime. Having a cool, a very cool and dark room. My wife doesn't believe in heat or air conditioning. So interesting. So my room is very, very cold. I wake up and it's probably in the mid 50s most of the time. But anything under, 65, 64 degrees, your body is more adapted, again, for obvious reasons, to sleep when it's cool. Mm-hmm. So again, in some ways, it's just asking yourself all those questions. How did I evolve? And how do I align myself with my biology?
Love that. Love that. Makes so much sense. Makes so much sense. Hey, tell us about your book. You got an online course called Good Stress. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Good Stress is my course on commune. So I'm feeling a little imposter syndrome given who else is on there. Mark Hyman and Gabor Mate and Zach Bush and Marianne Williamson and Deepak Chopra and Sadhguru and all these incredible folks that have influenced me so much. But there I am with my own course. And it's really a distillation of everything that I've learned, from my 400 plus interviews, into a very clear program that people can adopt into their life, that is made up of these, what I call good stressors. You know, some people think of them as adversity mimetics, essentially mimicking forms of adversity, Paleolithic adversity, like I've talked about. And I explain how to do them, the specific protocols themselves. I explain many of the benefits. And, it's funny, Louise, in many cases, many of these protocols have, spiritual and very old roots. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, newfangled hyperbaric chambers and ozone therapy and cryotherapy, and those are cool. And there's plenty of interesting people that are experimenting with those. I tend to focus more on the old and the true. And it is interesting how often they're baked into, our oldest traditions, Jesus and the Buddha and Muhammad were all fasters, and that fasting is really built into a lot of traditions. And there's a real deep spiritual component of fasting, candidly. It's funny, as I begin to adopt that protocol, I begin to witness my hunger in a different way. And, Viktor Frankl, who wonderful author who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, he said most famously that, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our freedom, our liberation. And so, when I was hungry before I adopted a fasting protocol, I wouldn't think about it. I would just mindlessly meander over to the cupboard and just grab whatever was in there, and snack away. But because I became sort of a disciple to, this particular practice, I couldn't do that. So I had to witness the nature of the stimulus, the hunger, and then wait and cultivate a certain kind of space. And in that space, I was able to really witness that hunger and delineate between whether it was a biological need or an emotional or psychological desire.
Good question.
And most of the time, it was the latter. Most of the time, it was because I was bored, or someone said something mean about me on Instagram, or I was eating my feelings, or there was some other reason for me being there that was psychological or emotional in front of the fridge. That capacity to find the space between the stimulus, the hunger, and the response, the stuffing of my face, really became incredibly protean and useful in other parts of my life, because if I could find that space as it pertained to food, I could also leverage it for technology or for shopping or for honestly how I, relate with my children of like, okay, they would do something that would irritate me. Okay, that was the stimulus. My response, my immediate reaction would be to get really mad, but, in cultivating the space before you would get mad, you would say like, okay, what is the nature of their behavior right now? And what is the best response that I could have, in reaction to that behavior? And so, that's why I kind of qualify the practice of fasting is very psychological and somewhat spiritual, because you do find a tremendous amount of freedom and liberation in that space, in that ability to witness the nature of stimulus, such that, you can respond appropriately and in an emotionally regulated way.
Yeah, I love that. And, gosh, years ago, I had a client who came back from China, and she had worked with a healer over there. And he told her, he said, you heal in the spaces. I never, ever forgot that, Jeff. And as you're talking about the space that you want to create in all different places, not just with the hunger, right? But in your life with your kids and everything else, I just really believe we do heal in the spaces. And it's about creating space for ourselves in all areas of our life. And I also believe that there's a space in the crevices of the brain that's been unexplored. And I've explored that. That's where we really do have the emotions and the traumas of the past get stuck. And when we clear them at the brain soul level, it like brings people back to being aligned and being 100% their soul truth. So we're very much aligned spiritually as you're explaining this to me and where you're coming from. I'm like, way cool. Like I'm in like, way cool. that's where I'm sitting. And, I talk to myself a lot. I think you do too. And you ask yourself good questions.
Thanks. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think, health in all of its expressions, spiritually, psychologically, physiologically, it tends to be a reflection of our ability to bounce back, essentially our ability to find balance, centeredness, homeostasis, equilibrium. There's a lot of words for it. And, you know, the body, again, is very engineered to do that physiologically. Excuse me. You know, our liver like titrates just perfectly when it's working well to just have the right amount of glucose in the bloodstream. You know, we have this perfect little acid base, acid alkaline balance in the body that almost never deviates. So there's all these, you know, we have excitatory neurotransmitters and inhibitory neurotransmitters, et cetera, that you know, when we're kind of in a place of centeredness, that, you know, again, these things find their balance. So, well, you know, I think one of the quests for our psychology and spirituality is always finding that ability to come back to center, you know, and we call it, you know, we see that in spiritual traditions, you know, in Zen, and it's often thought of as centeredness, or in Buddhism, we see it as equipoise or equanimity, et cetera. And really, I think that it is often should be like the target of our various practices is, you know, refining that ability to foster homeostasis or balance, you know, in your spirituality and spiritual life and your psychology and in your physiology. And in many ways, like the protocols that I have codified are really just that. They are the protocols that foster balance across, you know, all of the different components of what it means to be alive.
That's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Hey, let's turn the tables a little bit here and ask you a couple of personal questions. What do you do when you're not working? You're always interviewing people. I know you do an amazing amount of research. Let's get to know Jeff on the other side here. So what do you do in your free time?
Yeah, well, I am, you know, a heedful husband. My wife and I have been together for 36 years. We work together and play together quite a bit. There's no one I'd rather really spend time with. So we take a lot of walks, and that's, we just talk through things and find creative ideas. And we, you know, we've tend to work together, creatively in our own lanes. So that's a source of great gratification for me. And then, you know, I'm a doting dad. I have three daughters, three teenage daughters. So I also have a cabin and a shotgun. And one of them's off to college. And so, and then two are home, and the two that are home are avid dancers. So I'm often shuttling kids around to dance weekend dance competitions. That's all, you know, simultaneously awful and wonderful. And then, you know, just in my personal life, I'm a musician, very amateur. I can clunk out maybe, you know, 50 or 60 standards on the piano. So I love the old jazz American songbook. So I learn a lot of those songs, and I'm a tennis player. So I'm still avidly playing competitive tennis, which is a great way to get out of my head and to find flow and to spend, you know, be outside and be moving and generally spend time with like-minded people who like rackets.
That is so awesome. It has been such a delight to get to know you today. I'm really excited for all the work that you're doing on your masterclass, your commune platform. How can we access your good stress class on that platform?
Sure. Yeah. So if you go to One Commune, so that's O-N-E commune.com, /good stress, or just go to the onecommune.com, you'll see it right there. And you can just click in and register just with your email, and you get half of it for free. So you get the first five sessions for free. I think in the first five sessions, I cover in some great depth fasting, exercise and resistance training in particular, hot therapy like sauna, deliberate cold therapy like ice baths and cold showers. So you can go there and sign up, and And you'll get access, like I said, for free for 5 days or for 5 sessions. And then my podcast is called Commune, and it's on all the various podcatchers. So if you're interested in hearing from people 20 times smarter than I am, that's where you'll find them. I conduct a lot of interviews there, some very fascinating people. And like you said, I write a weekly Sunday essay that tends to be kind of humorous and sometimes emotional. And you can get that just by signing up on the Commune platform. And that's just free. You just get it every Sunday, and it's a fun read. That's most of my life. I'm on Instagram, sort of waxing alternately pathetic and poetic at me, at Jeff Krasnow. So if people do roam the Serengeti of social media, that's mostly where I am on Instagram.
Oh, that's so awesome. Thank you so much for your time today and all your wisdom. This has just been amazing and delightful. And you guys definitely want to check out, go to onecommune.com/goodstress and get Jeff's class here and listen to some of those amazing interviews on his podcast. He's a wealth of information and connection. So thanks again for being with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Louise. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your community.
Yeah, it's been really great. So, gosh, I just like we could go on forever. I can just feel it. You know, I could just sort of feel it.
To be continued,
maybe. Yeah, absolutely. So, everyone, remember, follow your heart, but take your brain with you. Mm-hmm.